I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah, a registered associate nutritionist and your favourite crazy bean. Full of Beans is on a mission to reduce eating disorder stigma and increase eating disorder awareness. Together, we will establish inspiring conversations with a range of individuals, including those with personal experience and their loved ones, as well as clinicians, researchers, and charities who are all working to increase the understanding of eating disorders. Using my personal battle with atypical anorexia and body dysmorphia, as well as my master's in eating disorders and clinical nutrition, we will together explore the experiences of like-minded individuals who are equally as passionate about sharing their stories to increase the understanding of eating disorders. Please note that this podcast discusses sensitive topics and should not be seen as a replacement for evidence-based therapy or treatment. Today I'm joined by Jess Griffiths, who is the clinical lead at BEAT. BEAT is the UK's leading eating disorder charity, and Jess works to oversee all the clinical aspects of the charity. BEAT's mission is to end the pain and suffering caused by eating disorders through helplines, campaigns, and support. I'm really excited to speak to Jess today about the future of eating disorder awareness. Hello, Jess.
Hi, Hannah. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming on. I'm so, so excited to speak to you. It feels unreal.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Oh, it's lovely to speak to you.
Oh, thank you. So thank you so much for joining us today. I know you have such a busy schedule, so I feel really honoured that you've come on the podcast to talk about all things eating disorders. Where I wanted to start with you today was to talk about BEAT, which is obviously such an incredible charity. So if someone's listening and they maybe haven't heard of BEAT before, could you just kind of describe what it is and what you aim to do through the charity?
So as you quite rightly said, you know, our main aim is to end the pain and suffering caused by eating disorders. And obviously, you know, for people who are suffering, but also, you know, families and kind of providing knowledge for professionals as well. So we have a real focus on early intervention and campaigning. And, you know, obviously one of the major things we're so proud of is our helpline and our services. You know, and they've really developed so much over the last year. So yeah, it feels like we try and cover all angles in regards to kind of policy, research, as well as support services and training.
Yeah, and I think it's fantastic, the like broad array of things that you do. You know, one of the things I think is so important is the kind of increasing the knowledge of the general community, medical staff. And I'm really interested in the whole like teaching medical professionals, especially on more about eating disorders. And I wondered if what BEAT are doing in that area for that, if you could explain that.
Yeah, so my history with BEAT is that actually I worked as a freelance trainer for them for about 5 years. And then I came on board literally during the first lockdown last year. So I don't really know what it's like to work for BEAT outside of the pandemic, but it's certainly been an exciting journey. So I came on board as the clinical training lead last April, so 2020. And the main purpose for that was really because we'd been awarded some funding from Health Education England to create a training package for fourth year medical students and foundation stage doctors. And I must say, it was like a baptism of fire. You know, it was kind of like, wow, this just seems like such a responsibility to come in. You know, we know that, you know, training for doctors has been on the agenda in terms of the PHSO delivery group, you know, the recommendations that came out of the Avril Hart case. So, you know, and liaising with the Faculty of Eating Disorders to do that, and Health Education England and the GMC. So that's what I came in doing. And you know, it's been just so exciting to create this package, and we you know, we finally got it out there now. So the e-learning modules are freely available. You can have a little look at them through the Beat website. So a huge passion of mine is training. It really is, because I think if you can communicate and get people, you know, health professionals to understand eating disorders better, then it just makes all those interactions, you know, with GPs, with, you know, in any setting, and it can be so many settings when it comes to eating disorders because of the physical side effects of the illness. That's been a real journey over this last year, and just for it to be endorsed by the GMC, NHS England have got behind it. It has just felt like we've really achieved something there.
And
I think the different arms of campaigning as well. So, you know, it's where, you know, across the charity, our campaigns team now are really trying to get that into medical schools and foundation deaneries as well.
Yeah. And I think that it's really like that work to me seems like one of the most important things that we need to do and that you have done, because, like, you know, GPs or medical professionals are always the first port of call for somebody. Well, not always, but majority of the time, that's where somebody goes. So, and I think there's been this rhetoric of, oh, GPs don't understand or whatever. But if you're not taught about it, how are you going to understand? You know, if you're present in a community where there's stigmas against eating disorders, that's kind of what you're going to take into practice as well.
And I think that's it. That's what I hear from GPs. Even my local surgeries popped in a few weeks ago for something, and I was talking about what we were doing. And they were like, oh my gosh, can you come in and do some training with us? This is my own GP surgery. And I'm like, yeah, totes. And they're desperate. You know, they really want to know how to help. They need to know so much. And I think, you know, that's not their fault that they haven't received that training. You know, we know that doctors on average for the whole of their career get 1.8 hours of training on eating disorders. You know, that's so little, isn't it? Little when you think how complex it is and the mortality rates that we know are quite high.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned just before as well that your team are doing campaigning as well. Is that, did you say that was campaigning to get that into like medical schools and stuff?
Yeah, so, you know, really, it's been such a complex process in terms of understanding how doctors' training works.
Yeah.
And whilst the GMC are kind of the natural people to go towards, actually each kind of medical school and foundation deanery create their own curriculum.
Okay.
So it's a really hard process to get something into the curriculum, because it means something has to come out. So, you know, in terms of trying to, I guess, coordinate a response, and we know it needs to be in the curriculum for doctors, and actually doctors are telling us they want to learn about it. Yeah, it's a very tricky process, and there is no standard way to do it. So we kind of thought, well, actually, as an organization, let's tackle them one by one. Let's, you know, let's get in contact with them. Let's share these resources. And also, you know, give them anything they need to be able to incorporate it into their training program. So we're trying to make it easy for them. You know, we're not trying to be a pain about it, but we know it needs to be taught. So, yeah, we've got a, you know, pretty robust strategy moving forwards with that.
Yeah. No, that sounds brilliant. And I think it's kind of like an initial thing that you think, oh, you know, it's fantastic. We need to train doctors and stuff. But then when you start looking into it, nobody knows the ins and outs of how doctors are trained. And it sounds a lot more complicated than maybe what somebody might think initially. I guess a question I have is, you know, it's absolutely fantastic, and don't think that I'm saying anything. It's just a query going forward. So the work that you're doing sounds like it's in medical schools. So is there thought of doing anything for kind of doctors that are already trained and working already?
Yeah, so the package, there's two different packages. The first one is for fourth year medical students, so they're not practicing yet. But the other package is for, you know, foundation stage doctors, so junior doctors. So they would already be on placement. And, you know, I really kind of had the vision of wanting to create something. I had this vision of like a junior doctor, hopefully not in the middle of the night, but in the middle of a busy shift. And, you know, they need to know something about eating disorders. And I just thought, all I want them to know is like, oh, I remember doing that Beat module. I know there was a load of resources on there that I could just pick up and use. And that's what we've done basically. We had a really lovely junior doctor who worked alongside us creating this content, and she produced this eating disorders pocketbook, and it's literally like a little fold-up document that you can put in your back pocket. It's got QR codes that link to marzipan guidance and assessment and things like that. And I suppose that was my vision for it, really, was that to have a lot of lived experience voices throughout so that they understand it, but then just some practical resources. So when they're not sure what they can do, dig that out, use it straight away.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, actually. I don't know whether I think I've spoken to you this about with you before, but I did something quite similar for my dissertation project, but with paediatric nurses. Yeah. And that was my like thing, is I wanted to create that handbook to be like, when someone's on a ward and maybe they think, actually, I kind of recognize this as an eating disorder, they can open it and then have the like little bullet points and it not be too much to take in. It's just like something nice to refer back to. So glad we both had the same idea.
Amazing. Well, I might call on you, Hannah, because we're doing the nurses one now. So,
oh, well, please, absolutely do. Yes, I'd be more than happy to help and get involved. And just kind of on the, I guess, subject of raising awareness and stuff, I think something that I've noticed definitely recently, you know, it's fantastic that, you know, I feel like eating disorder awareness has really, it's really going somewhere and a lot of conversations being had, people are coming forward, and that is absolutely fantastic. But before, I hadn't really noticed it because I think we were in lockdown and I was only speaking to my friends. Now that we're maybe going out a bit more and we're in larger groups, I think I've had a bit of a wake-up call in that a lot of people still don't understand eating disorders. So my kind of question, I guess it's just your opinion, is how do you think that, because I think in order to change the rhetoric around eating disorders, it's the people that necessarily aren't interested in them that we need to sort of get to and change their understanding. Do you have any idea of where we even start?
Wow, Hannah, that is a very good question.
It's a big one, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's sometimes the element of, sometimes we're just preaching to the already converted, you know, we need to find other ways of reaching people who don't know that they need to know it. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, some of the ways, you know, you might have heard of Dave Chawner, who you know, does quite a lot of awareness.
He is fantastic.
Oh my gosh, what a great
guy. He's so funny.
So funny. I was chatting with him yesterday and things like that, you know, he's been down to Bournemouth, which is where I live, and, you know, run awareness events in the Students' Union at Bournemouth Uni. And that's such a great way of reaching people who wouldn't necessarily find out about eating disorders. So I think we've got to be a bit more creative. But actually, I had some interesting conversations with Health Education England on the back of the kind of medical training project and the nurses project. They're really keen to kind of find different ways of raising awareness. So I'm excited about it. I'm not fully sure what the answer is, but I think when it comes to mental health, I think we need to, be a bit more creative and think outside the box. But how we do that, I'm probably open to ideas.
I think you're so right, though. I think in a way, sort of the, you know, if somebody comes to you with something and they kind of try to preach to you and say, this is what it is, this is why it's bad, this is why you need to change your ideas around it, it's all quite negative and you kind of shut down and you close off. But I think, like you said about Dave Chawner, like his comedy, like it sort of makes it jovial, but it also makes it easy to listen to. And I watched one of his sketches the other day where he said a woman came up to him and said, oh, I can help you, like here's a bag of crisps. And I think that's a really common misconception, but he wasn't saying, like, you know, he didn't get angry about the fact that she was like, oh, I can help you with a bag of crisps. Like he, you know, went about it in a really good way, in that that's not how you can help someone with an eating disorder, but here is how you can help someone. But because it was sort of like really easy to engage in, it just made it so much better. So I think you're right. We need to get creative rather than just like saying to people, this is an eating disorder and you're saying things wrong.
Yeah.
It's about changing that.
And I think it is. I think sometimes, you know, I'll be careful what I say here, but I think, you know, if we come across with that quite negative campaigning approach, I just don't know if people just tune out. I think I'm all about like showing a better way in a positive way. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, obviously, you know, some things just need calling out, don't they? Yeah. But I think people want to be empowered. I think it's the conversations that people are having on the street. It's a community response, I think, that is so important. And I suppose that's why I think, I spend, a good amount of time investing in, publicity stuff and doing interviews, because I just think any way we can reach the general public in a different arena, mm-hmm. It's spreading that message. So, forging links with people, in Eastern Swords Awareness, we did an Instagram Live with Bryony Gordon, for instance, and just trying to use those networks really to get the message out there in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think equally, and I know this is something that Beat really do focus on, is that support for parents and carers. And I think by getting the message out there, it actually helps people that have somebody who is struggling with an eating disorder. I've spoken to quite a few people recently who they've got family members that have an eating disorder and they just don't know what's going on, and they have no idea, because it seems like there's a lot out there, but actually I don't think, in the general population, that is quite getting through.
No, and I mean, I'm so pleased with what we've achieved, in terms of the carer support. It's massively accelerated over last year. And I just always think they're our best resource. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, they might be going to an appointment one hour a week, alongside the person they're supporting. They're doing the other 167 hours of that week.
Yeah,
that's so much time, and it's exhausting, and it's so isolating, because as you said, not many people actually understand, who do you talk to? So I think we've really gone for that focus of, right, let's look after you guys, let's empower you, let's skill you up, and let's look after you so that you can support the person that you're trying to look after and support and journey alongside. They're just incredible.
And I know that we do have quite a lot of parents, carers, loved ones that do listen to the podcast. I think it's quite refreshing to hear other people's stories and know that it's not just your loved one going through it. So if they are listening, what is it that Beat does provide? Because I mean, we've said how fantastic, isn't it? It's absolutely fantastic, but I don't think we've actually said what it is.
You have to say what we've got. Yeah. It would be very wise, isn't it? So we've got several things, really. There's a carer's pack. So if you were to ring the helpline, you get sent this beautiful, very colourful pack, which has got loads of information in for free. So ring up the helpline, ask for that. Please do access that, because we've got plenty of copies to give away and we want to give them to the people that need them. And then we have the Solace groups. So they're like peer support groups for carers. Mm-hmm. Quote me on this, but I think we've got like 21 groups running at the minute.
Wow.
Some of those will be kind of ring fenced for certain areas of the country, but that's obviously all on our website, so do check that out. And we just had some lovely feedback from those sessions, that just to meet people who get it is just so it's what's the word, I guess it's just just feel safe. You feel comforted, people aren't going to judge you. So those are the Solace groups, and I think about an hour and a half at a time, running all different times of the week. So that's that kind of peer support space. And then we know the evidence suggests that there's ways that a carer can communicate with their loved one that will actually improve recovery. So we have Developing Dolphins, which is a kind of skills-based workshop that you can attend, and the first couple of sessions are all about understanding eating disorders and looking at the animal analogies. So you might have heard of the kind of, whether you're being a bit of a kangaroo and a bit overprotective, or charging in like a rhino. So it talks through, I suppose, how you can identify your approach to the person with an eating disorder. And then there's kind of time and space to practice some communication skills, to learn how to communicate with someone with an eating disorder. And I don't deliver them now, but I did do. And it was just so wonderful to be able to journey alongside some of the carers and hear the amazing stories of, like, okay, you're not actually lying to me. It does work. These skills absolutely work, and I think that's what's so positive. And then on the back of writing Developing Dolphins, we then created Raising Resilience, which is kind of the next layer on from Developing Dolphins, which is also a skills workshop. So you can click onto those are five sessions of 2.5 hours, led by an eating disorders clinician, so, you know, someone who's already working in an eating disorder service. And I think there's something nice about coming along to a BEAT one, because it's not within the service. Obviously, there's good aspects of going on to a carer skills workshop that's within the service, but I think it's sometimes nice to have that objective viewpoint as a carer as well. All on our website, go on to www.beateatingdisorders.org.uk and go to the kind of supporting someone and support services, you'll find the info there.
I think like the providing support for carers is, I think sometimes like the individual that's actually the carer can completely overlook and focus 100% on their loved one because they want to them to get better. But I think that that work that you do with people is just completely invaluable, because nobody knows, and I don't think even the person that's struggling knows the best way to like support someone with an eating disorder. But by having, you know, you don't learn that in life, do you? That's something that's completely thrown on you, and it's sort of you need to know it right there and then to help someone, or at least you feel like you need to. But developing those skills, and I also think just being able to talk to other people about what they're going through with their families. I know I've spoken to my mum in the past, and she said if I just had one other person to be able to say, like, you know, Hannah is struggling with this, just to be able to vent that out, she'd then be able to recharge, come back calm, collected to help me. Whereas in our situation, you know, she didn't have that. So she just came back tired, frustrated, angry at what was going on, didn't understand because, you know, I didn't want to talk about it. So I think having those groups is just completely incredible.
Yeah, it totally is. And I think just hearing your mum's experience there, you just think, gosh, you know, it's my, one of my classic phrases is you can't pour from an empty cup. But I think sometimes carers are so often doing that, aren't they? They're not getting it topped up by having that conversation with a friend or someone who gets it. And so no wonder they get really stressed and burnt out themselves. So, my mum would say, and I don't know if you know Hannah, I've obviously gone through a process of recovery myself, but we were really lucky, I think, as we journeyed through it, that my mum and dad did have a real good support network, and I'm sure that made a huge amount of difference to actually my trajectory through recovery.
Yeah, absolutely. I think having that support for your loved ones as well as you is, you know, completely invaluable. And I didn't know whether you wanted to talk about your experience, so I didn't want to like bring it up, but is that why you got into, you know, working at BEAT and, you know, being in the role that you're in? Is that because of your own experience?
I'm very happy to talk about it. Anyone who knows me will know I say my husband says that I made a career out of a crisis. So
and that's exactly what I've done. I think it's, you know, I think there's two ways to go. You either forget about it and put it in a box, or you use it as like, you know, you're so passionate, you use it as your drive. And I think both of them equally are absolutely fine. Yeah. But
the narrative for me really is that, oh my gosh, recovery was so hard. It's the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life to convince, you know, you've got this voice in your brain telling you one thing and you basically have to ignore it. Like you have to trust other people more than you trust what that eating disorder is saying. And, you know, that is hard work. And I think battling through that and getting to the stage where I did get free, gosh, I just wanted to make it easier for other people in any way I could. So I knew quite early on, even when I was still in treatment, that that's what I wanted to do. And obviously you get the kind of, shouldn't do that, just wait until you're ready. But I think for me, it was, I suppose, you know, it was almost, and hear me out, it formed part of my recovery because I couldn't do one thing and then be lying about it. So in terms of, it's a bit more, I suppose, like drug and alcohol services, you know, they don't bat an eyelid really of people going on to their 12 steps and then becoming like staying part of the group. I think we're a bit slow with that with eating disorders. I think, you know, we say go away for 2 years and then come back. Whereas of course, hopefully in that 2 years, of course they've moved on with their lives. Of course they have. Whereas I'm keen on, you know, capturing those people and helping mentor them and thinking, actually, no, some of these people are our workforce, you know? Yeah. We know from all the kind of information out there. We're struggling to get a workforce right now, and I think people with lived experience are our biggest weapon in the fight against eating disorders. And I think it's totally possible. I just think there's a lot of work we need to do around defining recovery, keeping people safe. We're just a bit behind, I would say, innit?
Yeah. And that's a really good point you've made about sort of the, like, you know, you wouldn't say anything if somebody was an alcoholic and then they came through that and then they wanted to help other people. Whereas sometimes I know I felt personally, you know, when I was doing my master's, which I did in eating disorders, it was like, I was there because, you know, I was very close, I would say, you know, I feel fantastic about recovery now, but at that point I wouldn't say that I was as good as I am now, but I knew that it's what I wanted to do because, like you said, I wanted to help other people. But I remember sitting in the lecture theatre thinking, I'm such a fraud. Like, I'm there learning about eating disorders, trying to help other people, but I thought, I can't say that I've had an eating disorder, because everybody would be like, why the hell are you here? Like, you can't do this if you've had one yourself. But I think now, like, one, I think that rhetoric is bad because it means that people then don't want to open up about their experience because it's almost something that we should be shameful of. But two, like, I think I don't want to say this and it sound bad. There is a level of understanding that you can get, and you can only get that from having an eating disorder. And I'm not saying that I think that, you know, you can only work in eating disorders if you've had one, not at all. But I think there is some things that, you know, it just gives you that greater level of empathy for helping people.
No, I totally get that. And I think, you know, when I'm working with other health professionals, I think quite often they acknowledge that, you know, they acknowledge that, oh, Jess, you know, you've lived it, you really get it. And I must say, I've only ever seen it as a positive thing. You know, people gravitate towards me and think, oh, no, Jess, you really get it. Like, you know. But something of what you were just saying made me think, there's almost, you know, there's stigma across the board, but there's almost, to me, sometimes it feels like there's a real stigma in recovery. I can sometimes really sense this perception that a lot of people don't think it's possible to get fully better. And it frustrates me at times, because I sense it, but I just think we need to tackle it a bit more. I do feel like, you know, we need to remove that fear. There just seems to be a lot of fear around, including people in like peer support work, and I just think there's more work to be done to, I think, create a framework where everyone feels safe, so services will feel safe recruiting people, and people with lived experience will feel safe in their hands as well. I mean, early on in the days of getting stuck back in, I could absolutely tell in about 3 seconds whether someone thought I was recovered or not by the way they talked to me. Thankfully that doesn't happen quite so much now, but I really used to sense it a lot and felt quite dismissed.
Yeah, I think that could be quite hard. I think you're right, though. We almost, in the same way we need to change the rhetoric of what an eating disorder is, so not thinking about maybe the typical ideas that we have, almost need to change the rhetoric of what recovery looks like as well, because it's, and I've not thought about this, but so this is just my brain sort of coming out with it right now. But, you know, when we typically in society, when we think of an eating disorder, we think of a emaciated, white, middle class, young female. And when we think recovered, we think, you know, going out every day and eating cake and being so confident around food and loving the skin that we're in. But I think in the same way that eating disorders, I would say, are on a spectrum, and you can sit wherever you fancy, well, not wherever you fancy, but, you know, there's many places you can sit in it. I think recovery is the same. Like, for me, I think, sounds strange to say it, but some of the qualities of my eating disorder, I think, have made me a better person. And I don't necessarily want to lose those. So I don't think this idea that we're going to go back to the person we were before, as that's like your full recovery, I think that's the wrong way to look at it.
I totally agree. You've got those kind of core values, and some of those aspects made the eating disorder really not great and destructive, but channeled in the right way, are a force, you know, so helpful. But yeah, I totally agree. I felt like I was the new, improved and free Jess, you know, through recovery. But I think something you were just saying made me also remember that I You know, I think before I kind of engaged in working in services, you know, you said that you remember sitting in that kind of lecture theatre feeling a bit of a fraud. Well, I felt like that until I got stuck back in working. And I think I had this almost perfectionism in recovery of like, I must never have an eating disorder for ever again. Yeah. Otherwise, I'm a fraud. And then I was like, well, Jess, you really need to chill out because you have to eat every day. So of course you have to think about food. What is an eating disorder thought, Jess? And I really had to unpack that. And as I got to know, so I started working back in the hospital where I was treated, and I got to know some of the team. And then I was like, they all have issues. I'm like, oh my gosh. And for one person in particular, I'm like, I think I am actually more secure than them. And then there was this kind of like, everyone gets stuck back in working in mental health for a reason, don't they? They, you know, everyone comes with their story. And I think just I had to reframe what that looked like, doing life and life's messy. And actually everyone's in this business of life together, whether they've had an eating disorder or not, they've probably been through something difficult. So yeah, it was kind of a real awakening moment. But I think, you know, I can see that I felt the pressure to be perfect in my recovery, and I had to address that too.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you said about the word perfect, because I think, you know, for somebody that's had anorexia, the perfectionistic traits, that's what drives it. So there's no, you know, there's no question that when it comes to recovery, you are going to try and achieve the quote unquote perfect recovery. But what does that even mean? Like you said, you know, it's different for everybody.
It is different for everyone. And yeah, when that perfectionism grabs you, it takes you off into a direction that's not helpful. And, you know, I do have that personality. So, you know, early in the days of recovery, I'd set myself off in a direction and then have to bring back. Thankfully, I'm a little bit more middle ground than I was. I'm still learning. I'm still, you know, processing my personality and my vulnerabilities, probably like most people. But yeah, perfectionism, it can be so hard to recognize, I think, as well, like when you're in the middle of it.
Yeah. And I think, like, one of my friends always says, you know, eating disorder recovery is a bit like a pendulum. And I don't think you have like perfect life over, well, not perfect, we've used the word perfect again. Like, I don't even know what you call it because it's not normal. It's just like, no eating disorder thoughts over here, eating disorder thoughts over here. And I think every day you swing between it. I don't think it's necessarily you're constantly going to be at the no eating disorder thoughts for the rest of your life. And it's not you're going to be at the eating disorder thoughts for the rest of your life. It's just about, okay, if you do swing over that side, how do you bring yourself back onto that side? And how do you cope with those situations so that it doesn't go into a full-blown eating disorder again?
Yeah, and I think that's something that I find sometimes really hard to explain to people, because when they say, oh, so you're fully recovered, you don't have any eating disorder thoughts, I'm like, well, do you think about food? Do you think about your body at all? You probably do, because that's normal. So yeah, of course I do that. It just doesn't go anywhere. You know, if I don't let any negativity, I would say this is how I stay recovered. I don't let any negativity prosper, you know, around myself. Do I work hard to maintain a peaceful mindset? Not really, sometimes. Mm-hmm. Over the last year, a little bit more, with three kids homeschooling and whatnot. Wow. but generally, I don't have to work hard to keep my mindset positive. But for me, that's the key to recovery. That's what keeps me well, is me accepting myself and being positive about myself. That's what keeps me well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the key thing, isn't it? It's having that positive outlook on things and just keeping a positive mind. I suppose my question would be, if you feel like you don't work at that, do you feel like that is something that you had to work towards and now you have like things that you do to maintain that? Or is it kind of just like a natural thing that you do now?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think, you know, do I have to work at it? I would say I had to work at it this year. You know, this past lockdown was hard grind. And I think, you know, I worked super hard last year. And I think, you know, I think I had gone to a place where I was trying to make everything right for everyone, like with the kids, you know, having three children. I had to take a bit of a step back. I got into a little bit of a negative place. maybe ended up there before I really wanted to be. But, you know, I just think that's also normal. When I, you know, I think I just had to embrace that and say, just, you know what, you've had a really, you know, challenging year. It's okay. It's actually okay to fall apart a little bit sometimes. Mm. And I think if I, you know, if I was, I'm saying this obviously in a podcast, but I think a lot of people think, oh dear, what's going on there? But actually, isn't that just normal? What am I modeling to my children if actually there's struggles in life? I think once again, it's the pressure to be perfect. And actually life isn't like that. You know, life is actually, it's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to say you're struggling. So actually, I think for me, that was a real, you know, like I said, I'm always learning, but it was a real powerful lesson of be vulnerable is a real strength as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one thing that I've definitely tried to do through the podcast is to just be real. I think it would be very easy for me to like do this podcast and say every day's brilliant, I'm completely recovered and eating disorder's gone from my life. But I don't think that helps people, because then somebody that is a few years down recovery that's having a bit of a struggle will think, oh, well, I'm the only person that does. So I think
drives that perfectionism. So if I was to put it out there and say, oh, I never struggle, that's not fair on everyone I'm supporting. You know, I just try and be real. I know, in a sense, I've got nothing to hide, you know, but I think it is helpful to hear that to struggle is normal. And I think, like I say, as a mum, I'm conscious of what I model to them. Mm-hmm. And they need to see the reality of life and how to navigate those emotions and those various different challenges so they can tolerate it and become resilient.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think by you showing that difficult times happen, maybe they will then develop beneficial coping mechanisms rather than possibly the not so beneficial ones that then maybe lead to eating disorders. Yeah. So I think that's really fantastic that you are so open and honest about real life.
Well, hopefully, I think, you know, once again, that little perfectionism can creep into parenting, like being a mom.
I bet.
Oh, had to work through that one. I bet we're still working through that one as we approach the teenage years. But I think that's it. I think it's, you know, I think for a little while early on in, you know, being a mom, I was like, oh, are they going to get an eating disorder? Are they going to inherit some, you know, and it was a real fear for a little while. But actually, I think now I've realised, you know, there will be uncertainty, there will be difficult times, and I'm just got to give them the tools as best I can. Saving up for therapy already, to, you know, to be able to navigate the challenges of emotions and various life difficulties. So trying to chill out about it a little bit. Yeah. Don't always succeed.
No, but I think that's good. I think that it's like, you know, it's like everything, or like we've already spoken about, just showing that there are up days and down days. You can't get everything right all the time, can you? And I'm not a parent, and I hope I am not a parent for a very long time, but I know that I already stress about, oh god, what, you know, what if I give them an eating disorder? So it's really nice and refreshing to hear from you that, you know, it's not going to happen. You just need to help them navigate things well.
No, and it's, you know, my eldest, who's nearly 14, can you believe it? she just said, Mum, you know, she said to me in the kitchen the other day, she said, Mum, I really like myself. And it was just, I'm not sure that, I think, because we call her, we say we are the guinea pigs, you know, with you. Sorry, you're our first child. We get things like totally wrong. But I suppose for me, I was just like, so nice to hear a teenage girl.
Yeah.
She's confident in her body, and I'm not blowing my own trumpet, because I've completely fudged it as we've gone along. But you know, that's all I want for them, is just to be vaguely content in who they are. And they'll have moments when they're not, and she's had moments when she's not, but we've navigated them together.
Yeah, well, that's brilliant, and thank you for being so honest about everything. It's been absolutely lovely to talk to you, and yeah, I feel like we've got a very good insight into Beat, but also you, which I wanted to get to know you as well. So the last question that I've been asking people, and I feel like we've given a lot of tips today, but we'll just do it to keep it succinct with the other episodes, is what would be your top tip or your best advice for somebody who's looking to get on the path of recovery away from their eating disorder?
Yeah, really good one. Talk to someone as soon as possible that you trust. You know, it's the more time that goes by, the more ingrained those thoughts become. Mm-hmm. And recovery involves vulnerability. It's really uncomfortable. If it feels uncomfortable at that stage, it's probably the right choice.
Okay, fantastic, Jess. It's been so lovely to speak to you, and thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Hannah.
What an amazing opportunity to be able to speak to Jess about the work that they're doing at BEAT currently. I think BEAT is such an incredible charity, and the fact that they're so passionate about helping parents and carers is so important and really reflects the insight that they have into eating disorders. Next week, we'll be joined by Andrea Claris, who is a registered associate nutritionist, and she works with Talia, who was on last week. Andrea joins us to discuss all things intuitive eating, and it was a really fantastic conversation because not only did Andrea bring her extensive knowledge, but she also brought her personal experience and a lot of the queries I had with regards to intuitive eating, eating disorders, hunger and fullness, she was able to really clearly answer.
So when people have an eating disorder, we don't start with intuitive eating just straight from the start. Mm-hmm. We start process of nutritional rehabilitation and weight restoration. We start this by establishing a regular pattern of eating in order to fix that broken hunger and fullness meter.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe to be one of the first to hear it. Please also like, comment and share this podcast with anyone you feel that may need support at the moment. Not only those struggling with eating disorders, but also their loved ones, as this can be a very difficult time for everyone. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, and this podcast aims to motivate and inspire individuals along their path of recovery. If you are struggling with an eating disorder, charities like BEAT, SEED and First Steps have great resources. Please also reach out to your local GP to see how you can gain support for your eating disorder. See you next time. Bye!